Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Investigators trying to piece together last week's murder of a wealthy Pensacola couple known for adopting special needs children now say they've recovered a safe that was stolen from the couple's home in Florida, along with several guns, including what they believe is the gun used to murder Bird and Melanie Billings. Eight suspects, some of them caught on surveillance cameras, wearing what police called ninja clothing, entering the Billings home with military-style precision, have been arrested. There have been rumors flying about drug involvement in the case and an international criminal gang, but Florida State Attorney Bill Edens told reporters today they're nearing the end of their investigation.
In our opinion, this was a home invasion robbery where the people stole a safe, and we recovered the safe, and we think it's as simple, and I personally, and the sheriff can speak for himself, think it is as simple as that in terms of the motive and the what occurred.
Tom Ninestein is breaking news editor for the Pensacola News Journal there in Pensacola. Tom, I know you've had many questions about this case all along. Do you think it's as simple as that after hearing today's press conference?
Well, it sounds like they're fairly confident, and we're going to take law enforcement at their word, obviously. But, you know, the entire episode has just raised a lot of eyebrows of even some veteran news people in the room, that many people involved for what appears to be a robbery of a safe. Perhaps they wanted to have a strong show of force.
Yeah. Well, you and I spoke earlier today.
Yeah.
The press conference here on the East Coast was delayed for an hour, and that seemed to further fuel rumors that there was something bigger than a break-in going on. ABC News has been reporting that federal sources tell them that the suspects might have connections to a drug-running gang. Was any more said about that after the press conference?
Not after the press conference, and Sheriff Morgan stressed both before and a couple times during the news conference that is available on our website, pnj.com, if your listeners would like to take a look at that. But he stressed that right now his investigation is solely on the eight suspects involved in this horrific crime. Now, we've heard some of the same rumors. We're trying to track down information from the DEA, but there's been no suggestion that this was part of any kind of drug running at the moment.
County Sheriff David Morgan also confirmed earlier today that it was he who had called in federal drug agents, not to investigate the Billings, by the way. There were rumors flying about that.
That's correct.
But he also had previously told the Today Show that there would be an international element to the story. Do we know more about that?
Well, no, we don't. You just wonder if there was a large amount of cash or jewelries or valuables that were in the safe in question, whether that was going to be taken to another country or try to be fenced and the proceeds of that move somewhere.
Yeah. Well, and I'm wondering also if there's any more to be known about two of the suspects who had military backgrounds. One was a former National Guardsman and martial arts teacher, another an Air Force mechanic with 5 tours of duty in Iraq. We mention this because separately this week we received a report from the Army about their investigation into a spate of killings involving troops from Fort Carson in Colorado Springs, Colorado. The Army saying that those killings and a national number of killings by troops may be linked to troops who saw fellow troops killed in Iraq, and the Army's very concerned about that. Now we have 2 suspects in Florida with military backgrounds. Presumably, they'll add to the national tally that the Army itself is keeping of troops charged with killings. Is anyone there in Pensacola talking about that element?
Not at all, as far as using their military background to pull off this heist. Sergeant Stallworth certainly has a much more recent career in the military than Mr. Gonzalez Jr., who has set up a couple of businesses and been somewhat prominent in the community in Northwest Florida.
Well, we mentioned 7 men arrested. Also, a woman has been arrested named Pamela Long Wiggins. Sheriff Morgan had said he was looking for someone he thought was supposed to have a role in the crime, disabling the video cameras in the home. That obviously failed because there's all sorts of footage. But is it thought that that woman might be connected to that?
Certainly.
At least in the police mind, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Especially as this unfolded over the weekend and earlier this week, when they did tip their hand a little bit by saying that clearly someone was assigned to disable the surveillance equipment at the home, whether physically disabling the cameras at the home or by doing it from a remote access via computer.
Tom Ninestein, a breaking news editor for the Pensacola News Journal. After a press conference in Pensacola, police there saying they believe that this is a home invasion robbery. And so, Tom, it sounds like if that remains true, it's one that went horribly, horribly, tragically wrong.
Robin, I can't wait for the next chapter of this thing to appear.
Yeah. Tom, thanks very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Thunder and lightning. July is the peak month. In fact, lightning delayed the launch of the space shuttle this past week, though Endeavour did manage to launch last night. So far this year, 23 people have died in the U.S. from lightning. But did you know that lightning is responsible for more than 10,000 fires annually and causes an estimated $5 billion in damage every year? That's just one fact in a fascinating book, Out of the Blue, A History of Lightning, Science, Superstition, and Amazing Stories of Survival. It's recently out in paperback. We spoke to author John Friedman last year when the book was first published, and with lightning season upon us again, we thought we'd revisit that conversation. We began by asking him just what lightning is.
Lightning is a powerful electrostatic discharge that occurs in the Earth's atmosphere as well as on Venus, Jupiter, and Saturn. Scientists, though, really are not exactly sure what causes lightning. One theory is that droplets of rain and ice become electrically polarized as they fall through the atmosphere's natural electric field. Another theory suggests that colliding ice particles become charged by electrostatic induction as they are in the atmosphere.
Huh. And who knew there are so many stories related to lightning? In 1228, Thomas Aquinas, when he was a child, lightning struck the tower where he was sleeping. He was spared. It killed a sister. Can you just tiptoe a little bit through history and remind us of the different ways that lightning was viewed? You know, as you write, the ancients thought it was magic from the sky. But even Socrates talked about it, and, you know, it's in the New Testament.
Exactly. Probably the earliest depiction of lightning occurs in Western Australia, where about 20,000 years ago, prehistoric rock engravings show a figure with his hair standing on end. This is the state that occurs right before a lightning flash happens, when the hair in one's arms or one's hair will stand up a little bit. Every society, every culture has had a lightning deity. The Chinese told of Lu Tzu, the god of thunder. The ancient Vedic books of India described Indra, who carried thunderbolts on his chariot. The Mayans worshipped Apeku, the Irish, the Polynesians. They all had lightning deities. Hmm.
Greek mythology had Zeus, of course, who used lightning to punish. As I mentioned, the New Testament, lightning usually meant a revelation. But tell us about the time in the 1700s when there were medieval religious attitudes toward lightning, that it was punishment from God. And if you rang church bells, you could ward it off.
There was a belief in the Middle Ages that if you had church bells ringing during a thunderstorm, that lightning would not strike the church or the surrounding buildings. Unfortunately, many of the church bell ringers themselves were struck.
I don't mean to laugh because it's just terrible, but I'm looking at the book that was published in Germany, Proof that the Ringing of Bells During Thunderstorms May Be More Dangerous Than Useful.
Well, it's interesting that in 1786, the Parliament of Paris issued an edict prohibiting bell ringing during storms. But as late as 1824, four new bells were, quote, baptized against lightning and placed in the Cathedral of Versailles while government officials took part in the ceremony.
I mentioned the Catholic intellectual St. Thomas Aquinas. Martin Luther had an encounter with lightning?
Yes, he did. Luther was, at the time, a young German law student. And in 1505, while traveling to visit his parents in early July, there was a severe thunderstorm that surprised him. Lightning struck very nearby, perhaps throwing him to the ground. And at the time, in fear of death, he called out to St. Anne, who was his father's patron saint, with the rather surprising news, I will become a monk. 2 weeks later, Luther honored this promise and entered the mendicant order of Augustinian monks.
And went on to invent Protestantism.
Exactly.
You know, we can trace Protestantism perhaps back to lightning. It's just remarkable. I want to continue with the history, but in modern day, you met so many people who also had the same experience. Their lives were changed by lightning. Tell us some of the people who were hit by lightning and how it affected them.
Well, the interesting thing, Robin, is that a number of people have been hit many times by lightning. I interviewed, for example, a man in Oklahoma City who was struck 6 times, and he has no ill effects from any of the strikes. I asked him if anything bothers him, and he smiled and he said, well, my knees are kind of weak, but I don't think that's due to lightning.
Well, but then others have been killed, but terribly affected physically.
That's absolutely true. One of the things about lightning is that it's so hard to predict what effect it's going to have on its victims. Some people walk away without any injuries. Some people are crippled for life. Some people lose their memory. I interviewed in person and in depth about 25 survivors. What I noticed was that nearly all of them felt that they had been saved by God for some purpose, but they didn't know exactly what the purpose was. However, they all seemed to be better people in the sense that they were more generous, more unselfish, more caring of others.
You meet many of these in a lightning support group, people who gather together to talk about this experience because it's so unique. What is it about being struck by lightning that people tell you? And again, every experience is different, but what is it? Is it they felt an electric field or that they saw angels when they were out?
The experiences vary from a mountain climber who was on the Grand Teton several years ago, who sensed a buzzing in the air as if a swarm of insects were present right before he was struck. On the other hand, many people are struck out of the clear blue, have no warning. They're just completely surprised that lightning decided to hit them.
Well, and why does it hit one person, and in some cases, not the person standing right next to them? You have several accounts, a father holding a child, the father killed the child fine, a family of three in 2004 walking down the steps at the University of Florida, Pensacola, all are hit, all three knocked unconscious, the daughter goes into a coma. This is part of what these survivors grapple with. Why me and not the person standing right next to me?
This is something that is still perplexing scientists. People just don't know. But you mentioned the case of the young woman. She was struck and to this day suffers terribly. She has trouble speaking. She has trouble remembering. She's in pain. Her parents escaped with barely any injuries.
So how do you protect yourself? We'll be back with more from John Friedman, author of Out of the Blue, in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with John Friedman, author of Out of the Blue, A History of Lightning, Science, Superstition, and Amazing Stories of Survival. Did you know that a typical lightning flash lasts less than half a second, but in that time it can release about 250 kilowatt hours of energy, enough to power a 100-watt light bulb for more than 3 months? Did you know if you're mountain climbing, you should remove ropes because lightning can travel across them, especially if they're wet? Houses are safe because lightning travels down the plumbing and wiring, but that's why you're not safe if you're in the tub or on a landline phone. I asked John Friedman if lightning can also travel through cell phones and iPods.
There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that seems that lightning is conducted through cell phones and iPods. However, the medical profession, and there are only about half a dozen medical specialists in the world who are experts in lightning medicine, tend to discount this.
And yet there's that one case you write about, a runner, lightning storms going on, so he takes refuge, and he's got the iPod earbuds in his ears with the wires coming down his chest. And isn't that where there was the burn mark down the wire?
Absolutely. And again, the medical profession says, well, this is a very isolated case. He might have been struck even if he did not have an iPod on. And I think research, a lot of research is still necessary to find out what actually happens in such cases.
This is one of the problems, too, that you write about, that there is so little known medically about lightning strikes. People believe, for instance, that someone who's struck by lightning shouldn't be touched because they're a conveyor of electricity. Is that true?
No, that's a myth. And unfortunately, many people have suffered after they've been struck because people around them are afraid to touch them. But there is no harm in touching someone who's been struck.
What do we know about who gets struck? There are other people who seem to be struck many times. And by the way, some of them told you they feel there's something inside them. One woman even said, I set off metal detectors in airports after her first strike. She believes that there's something from that first strike that's still in her. Is there any truth to that?
Well, I interviewed a number of people who said that as a result of the strike, they affect electronic devices. For example, one man said that he cannot use computers because every time he sits down at the keyboard and starts the computer, it freezes. A woman told me that she used to be a motorcycle instructor. Now when she rides her motorcycle down the streets, traffic lights, street lights start going on and off.
Some people who have been struck, too, tell you that they feel as if they're very clear about it. Again, every case is different, but they're very clear. It hit me in my right thumb and went straight through me to my left toe. Do we know how lightning goes through us?
Well, it seems to follow the path of least resistance, and usually lightning goes on the surface of the skin because that's where the moisture is, and that's where the perspiration might be, and very often the burns that occur from the intense heat.
There were so many women, I noticed, at their kitchen sink with windows in front of the kitchen sink. We can picture that, you know, cutting up a potato or something, struck standing there at the kitchen sink. And one woman said to you that she'd had a bad leg from an accident before the strike, and afterwards her leg improved.
Yeah, she was a woman I interviewed in Florida who had a couple of metal plates in her leg. She had been struck once. She was struck a second time. And in a very strange occurrence, she said that she used to have difficulty walking before the second strike. After she was struck again, she had no problem walking at all. She says this is a miracle. And such instances are rare, but they have been reported.
Which brings us back to sort of the religious nature of lightning. We're reminded that when Ben Franklin invented the lightning rod, you know, he attached a rod to a roof and he conducted electricity to the ground. And you quote a religious figure saying, it was as impious to ward off heaven's lightning as a child warding off the chastening rod of his father. And it became part of a very big spiritual discussion. Ben Franklin said he didn't think, you know, God really cared about micromanaging people's lives through striking them with lightning. With the people who are struck today, is it still part of a religious discussion for them?
Very much so. Many of the people who have been hit today believe that they have been spared by God, and they become much more religious. They turn to their faith. And interestingly enough, some people have even been struck while working at a church or working in some church group.
How can ordinary Americans today best protect themselves from being hit by lightning?
Well, experts say that the 30-30 rule is the best way to protect yourself. The 30-30 rule says that after you see lightning, count the time until you hear thunder. If 30 seconds pass or less, take shelter immediately. Then, after the last lightning strike that you see, wait at least 30 minutes before going outside.
Huh.
And the best place to take shelter is in an automobile.
There's just so much here. Someone's more likely to be hit on a weekend summer afternoon standing under a tree or boating or golfing. The greatest risk is Lightning Alley from Tampa on Florida's west coast to Titusville on its east. Many cases of Boy Scouts being killed.
Many of these scouts were out camping. They were in the mountains, so they were natural targets.
Let's stick with scouting and camping. Should you go under a tent if it's got a metal pole?
It's better not to. It's better to stay very close to the ground. Experts used to say that a crouching position was the safest. Now they're not so sure. But the point is, stay away from all metal objects and stay away, of course, from high objects.
Like a tree.
Exactly.
Yes, everybody goes under a tree, and that's exactly where they get struck.
I wanted to add that the most dangerous place to be in the United States is in Lightning Alley, which you talked about in Florida, yeah. In July on a golf course. Most of the accidents occur in the summer months, and they usually occur in the late afternoon.
Well, note to myself, no golfing in July in Florida. That wasn't going to happen anyway. But our conversation with John Friedman, his book is Out of the Blue, A History of Lightning, Science, Superstition, and Amazing Stories of Survival. It's now out in paperback. Everyone stay safe this summer. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the employment outlook may be grim, but not if you're a healthcare lobbyist. They're very busy, and they include more than 300 former government workers and retired members of Congress. We'll hear about them tomorrow. And we'll be back after the latest news. That's next, Here and Now. We have news now on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. In Afghanistan, local Taliban commanders are threatening to kill a captured American soldier unless the U.S. military stops operations in two districts in southeastern Afghanistan. Neither district is in the Helmand province, where Marines are currently conducting the largest U.S. military operation since the Taliban was toppled from power after 9/11. The U.S. military has not identified the soldier, but says his family has been notified he's missing. Meantime, more than 20 Iraqis who worked for British forces in Iraq are planning to file a lawsuit against the British government tomorrow. Most of them were interpreters who claimed they weren't protected from attacks by insurgents who labeled them collaborators. Some of the interpreters were kidnapped and tortured, others forced to leave their homes in Iraq, and they're now living as refugees in Syria or Jordan. The BBC's Angus Crawford has a report.
When his best friend was murdered, Jamal knew he couldn't go on working for the British.
He was kidnapped from home, and he was tortured, severe, merciless torture, and got killed and thrown in a deserted, remote place.
For Jassim, it was the anonymous death threats he received on his mobile.
We know where you are working, you know your house, what time you went out, what time you came in to the base.
Neither wants to use their real name. Jassim now lives as a refugee in Syria. Jamal is in hiding in Basra. His family constantly worrying about his safety.
It was like a daily nightmare for them. Whenever I was going out, they were thinking of me, they were fearing, and they were expecting the worst for me. It was just like a very, very bad situation for them.
Both applied to come to the UK under a scheme set up to help local staff employed by the British. But neither had served continuously for 12 months, so they failed. Now, this week, they'll begin legal action to sue the government for compensation.
For me, I'm looking for my children to have good country, good treatment. I'm not looking for myself.
Some people might say you were lucky to have a job with the British. You left that job and maybe now you should just get on with your life in Iraq. What would you say to them?
If they knew my situation, they wouldn't say that.
They feel very let down by the government. They literally, in some cases, put their lives on the line for the army.
Sapna Malik is a partner at the solicitors Lee Day and is coordinating the actions, 25 of them in total, mainly interpreters, though three claims are being made by the families of men murdered by militias. She says the government owed them a duty of care.
The MOD could certainly have taken better steps to protect the identities of the interpreters from the militia in the first place. They could have better patrolled the routes taken by interpreters to and from the bases. And in certain cases, they should have housed the interpreters on the bases.
I certainly feel a sense of moral obligation. Since I've been back from Iraq, I've been in contact with a couple of interpreters who worked for me. It's very frustrating not being able to help them.
Adrian Wheel is a former Army intelligence officer. He had to hire local staff, but says he was given little guidance, even when threats against them escalated.
There really was need for a big change, not a sort of gradual implementation of protective measures. We should really have moved the interpreters, made much more effort to disguise them and perhaps house them in secure environments.
But that didn't happen and you weren't ordered to do so?
That didn't happen during my period and certainly I was never ordered to do that.
I would also like to take this opportunity to pay tribute to the work of our civilian and locally employed staff in Iraq.
2 years ago, the Prime Minister announced new help for Iraqi employees, financial assistance or resettlement for those who'd served a year. 612 have come to Britain. Hundreds of others have taken the money. But almost 700 have been told they don't qualify.
Who work for our armed forces and civilian missions.
Recently, in a written statement, the Foreign Secretary praised the dedication and commitment of local staff and said the scheme was designed to reflect Britain's enduring debt to them. He described it as popular and effective.
I feel so disappointed and I feel that I'm let down.
Jamal, though, would disagree. He sees no option but to take legal action against the government, which he believes has abandoned him.
Welcome back to Here and Now. We've spoken here about the nearly 370 kidnapping cases in the last year alone in Phoenix, Arizona, where drug dealers are constantly held for ransom and people recently smuggled into the country are also being kidnapped by the mules that brought them and then want more money from them. We're learning more about the drop houses where the kidnapped victims are held. These are houses sometimes teetering on foreclosure with absentee landlords, often speculators. Phoenix Police Sergeant Tommy Thompson joins us. Sergeant, tell us more about these houses.
Phoenix has some unique characteristics that lends itself to this problem. First of all, we're very close to the Mexican border. We're within 150 miles. But because we're so close, it makes it possible for the people to be able to walk across the desert or to be transported in vehicles. Second, because of the fact that we were in the Sun Belt area that experienced a huge boom in housing, we had a number of people who purchased houses as real estate investments. And of course, if you have a property such as a home, as an investment, you want to make sure that that stays rented out.
Well, and we understand that many people were renting them out while they were waiting and hoping to flip them and make a little more money on them. But then, of course, the real estate bubble just burst. And so now they have all these houses. And I'm imagining that people might be desperate to get people in and may not look too hard at a resume. And then you have smugglers renting your house.
Exactly. You hit the nail on the head. We call the people who come to rent those properties straw renters, and that would be, again, a man and a woman quite frequently who shows up, and you've got a landlord who thinks that this is the luckiest day he's ever come across or she's ever come across, but the problem is those people are simply a front for the organization that's running either the drugs or the smuggled humans.
Well, and tell us more about this. Again, we've spoken to reporters Chuck Bowden and Sam Canonis about this huge kidnapping crime wave because people are holding Mexican immigrants hostage, people within the drug trade, as you said, illegal immigrants, all sorts of reasons that they're calling up families and holding these people for ransom. What else happens to the people being held in these houses?
Again, referring specifically to those that are in the drop houses, that refers primarily to those who are brought into the country illegally, whether it's to obtain employment or to meet with other members of their family. For whatever reason, they pay a coyote. Well, oftentimes those coyotes turn into be suspects. They'll hold them at gunpoint. Sometimes they're tortured. Sometimes the women are sexually abused, as are the men. And while they're being tortured or abused, it's very common for the coyotes will get on a phone, they will contact the victim's loved ones, and they'll say, "We need more money, or we're going to continue to torture your loved one."
We are reading horrifying descriptions of what's happening in these houses. The Wall Street Journal describes one in El Mirage. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this. It was on West Columbine Drive, a very suburban area, but as you said, a lot of foreclosures, so only a third of the 34 homes were occupied. Police managed to find this house because someone got a 911 call out and there was a smoke alarm chirp in the background, so they tracked down the house that had a smoke alarm going off. And they found people sealed inside a room with plywood, keeping the doors closed, half naked, packed together. It sounds horrific.
First and foremost, we treat these people as victims. It's very common to find 20, 30 people. We found as many as 40 or 50 in these homes. And again, they're held while money is extorted from their loved ones. And it's a terrible situation that we hate to see come upon anybody.
Well, how's this possible? We read about another home that was found on West Madison Street, Deadbolt locks had been installed on doors. Windows were sealed. There was a video system set up so guards could monitor the rooms. And you find yourself asking, if it's a foreclosed house, where's the bank? If it's a rented house, where's the landlord? Where are the neighbors? Doesn't anybody see that this is going on?
That's generally how we find out that it is a drop house, is we get a tip from a neighbor, or it's someone who escapes from those houses.
But then as a police department, what do you do? Because, as you said, they become horribly victimized. There's another comment from a Lieutenant Robert Smart of the Arizona Department of Public Safety, who said you can tell how long victims have been sitting there because there's a dark black stain that runs the length of some of the rooms, and that's where they've been sitting. The darker it is, the longer they were there. What do you do, because they are victims, but they're also illegal?
Well, we look at them as victims first, and we want to make sure that we get them out of that abusive situation, and then we look at their status on why they're there. The second type of kidnapping victims that we have are those that are the smugglers themselves. They're either involved in drug smuggling or they're involved in smuggling illegal aliens. The people that kidnap them are trying to get their drug money back, or the victims have lost a cargo of dope, or different things like that.
So, do you ever find yourself rescuing someone who then down the road turns out to be the perpetrator?
That happens. That happens because we're dealing a lot with the criminal element. The first thought that many people might have is, wow, you have criminal versus criminal crime. Why don't you just, you know, let them take care of each other? I even had one reporter say, well, it's like a self-cleaning oven. Mm. And I just kind of cringed when I heard that, because one of the things that we have learned in our experience is in dealing with the Mexican authorities 10 to 15 years ago, they looked at it and said, you know, it's bad guys versus bad guys. Let them take care of each other, and the winners will take to jail. And we just can't afford that. We in Phoenix are taking the steps to make sure that this stops.
What do you tell people in Phoenix, people who might be desperate to rent these homes that they bought thinking that they were going to flip and make money off of, and now they're losing their shirts? We understand with 500 drop houses that you've found, no absentee owner, landlord has been charged. Should there be some sort of a fine, at least, so that people are more diligent about renting out these homes?
I think it's very difficult to set up a law to hold them accountable. I think what the landlords can do is they can ask for references. When we have an economic situation where people are desperate to rent their properties, sometimes they take shortcuts that normally wouldn't be taken. But if you look at it from the perspective of that truly is an investment, and if it's been used for a drop house for a month or 2 months and I've got to tear out all the carpet, repaint everything, then how much of an investment has it really been for me? I really lose the value of my investment property.
That's Phoenix Police Sergeant Tommy Thompson talking about the phenomenon of drop houses in Phoenix, rental homes in areas with high foreclosure rates that are used by kidnappers to hold hostages. Sergeant Thompson, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity and hope all's well with you.
Okay. Well, we'll be back in a minute with the mythic properties of the Three Wolf T-shirt. That's in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back. And let's take a second for some of your thoughts. We spoke this week with Boston Globe reporter Allison Lobron about bottled water, how it's harmful to the environment, how tap is often just as good, and in fact, how the best-selling bottles like Aquafina are from a tap. Well, Craig Cheatham of Santa Cruz, California wrote, "I prefer the taste of a bottled brand from New Zealand, but I don't agree with shipping water around the world, so I do drink Aquafina, which is bottled right here in my state. And I thought it was unfair to characterize it as tap water. It is public water, but it's then charcoal filtered, demineralized using reverse osmosis, then treated with UV and ozone with minerals added back in for taste." Okay, Craig, duly noted. We also recently had a primer on buying health insurance and making sure you're actually covered. We mentioned a report from the Wall Street Journal about a woman whose outpatient service allowance was only $5,000. When she was diagnosed with cancer, her outpatient services, blood tests and such, quickly added up to over $80,000. Well, James Brogdon III, an independent insurance agent in South Bend, Indiana, was insulted. He writes, "I've never sold a limited benefit plan because I've never met a client I felt would get adequate value out of that plan. And I'm sure if you poll other agents, you'll find a similar story. But the fact is, it is the consumer's responsibility to know the cost of the services she's receiving." But many consumers were inadvertently furious about the segment. Michael Holland from Bozeman, Montana writes, "Check your deductibles, exclusions, benefit limits, emergency room exclusions, on and on and on. We need the simplicity of a Medicare-for-all single-payer system." And Elaine Demers adds, "I know you meant well, but maybe instead you should teach us how to organize protests to demand universal health coverage now, a pox on all their insurance houses." And finally, recently we featured a story on books for kids 9 to 12. We spoke with librarian Sherry Eskin. And 11-year-old Julianne Mosier had some objections. She's on the line. Julianne, first of all, you didn't like being called a tween?
I just sort of didn't like how they'd use tweens as markets.
You felt that using the word tween and making you like a market, you compared yourself to a dog?
Yeah, like you're going to take the dog and you're going to feed him like cheese, for example, and have him do a trick for you.
But you also had your own suggestions. And I know, first of all, you love Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Yeah. What were the books outside of Harry Potter that you wanted to recommend to kids?
Well, I think The Chronicles of Narnia is really awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Great Brain books are really good because it talks about this kid who has a really good brain, and he always comes up with these ideas to get more money or to save the town or whatever.
Now, the Great Brain books, these are author J.D. Fitzgerald's. He wrote them a long time ago. It's set in the West in old time days. I think one of the books is about the first toilet that comes to town.
Yeah, that was funny. And then the parents are morons, which is something that's really nice. And then usually they end up in trouble, and then the parents always comes and rescues them from it.
In the Great Brain books?
Yeah.
And you like that the parents come and rescue them in the end?
Well, yeah, it's realistic. It's not like the parents are going to say, oh, yeah, you can go and jump off a cliff or whatever. The kids get in trouble, and the parents actually come and rescue them.
Yeah. Unlike some of these modern books we talked about, frankly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we always are open to learning something new. Thank you so much for helping us out with Books for Kids for the summer.
You're welcome.
And we'll have Julianne's book picks along with ours at our website, hereandnow.org, where you can also click on and send us your thoughts. One final observation. Earlier this summer, a T-shirt made by a New Hampshire company hit number one on Amazon's bestseller list. It's black with three gray wolves howling at a full moon. It's still selling and still generating online reviews. Here's one posted yesterday by HSW from Tennessee. He writes, "I received this shirt for my birthday. Now my life is much more complicated. I don't know if people are attracted to me because of who I am or what I'm wearing. I don't know who to trust anymore." What? Michael McGloin is creative director of The Mountain. They make the shirt. Michael, this started with a tongue-in-cheek review from a law school student. He wrote, "Once I tried it on, that's when the magic started." When did you start to notice that your T-shirt had become an online cult?
It got forwarded to us by somebody in our company, probably around review 110 or so.
It went into a lot of college comedy online sites. But, you know, the reviews are funny.
Yeah.
But they're also making fun, in some cases, of people who might buy the shirt. Maybe there's some class stereotypes here. We mentioned Brian McGovern. He also writes, "I walked from my trailer to Walmart with a shirt on and was immediately approached by women who wanted to know if I would be their boyfriend and give them money for something they called meth."
Yep.
You know, it goes on that way. How do you guys feel about that?
I actually wrote a statement on Amazon just not being all that cool with when, you know, it becomes a classist thing. That was troubling for our company. But, of course, we see the humor in the majority of the statements.
Well, here's another review. A guy who writes, "I'm just a regular guy, got a truck, smoke a little too much. Most of my income went to the good life, brewed high in the Rockies, if you know what I mean. But one day I decided to take some hard-earned dough and upgrade big time. When I got my Three Wolf Moon T-shirt, I knew my life had changed." So, obviously, you know, they're making a little bit of fun of this while buying the shirt.
I think that's the key, that people are buying the shirt. A lot of good luck things have actually happened to people in the shirts, like a woman up the street who works at the Marlboro County convenience store right up the street from our production center. She was wearing the shirt, and she won four tickets to the VIP booth at the Red Sox game. it's like anything else. Like, if enough people believe in something, it really starts to kind of turn the corner.
Well, and we know what these shirts look like. You can see them with coyotes on them, and they're usually sold at fairs.
You know, our shirts sell all over the world. We sell to 90% of the zoos. We sell to all the aquariums. You know, of course, we do have customers who are convenience stores or truck stops. We have Will Ferrell was wearing, you know, our shirts in movies.
Because the T-shirts are worn, you know, by Will Ferrell and when he's in character to sort of telegraph a blue-collar American. But you wanted to make it clear that you're not some sort of company that's trying to make fun of people.
Oh, 100% not. I went on Amazon like 100 or so reviews in and kind of stood up for the company and said, hey, you know, some of the people you're making fun of are some of the people who work for us,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's not something that we like, but we love the free publicity. Thanks.
Right.
You know?
It reminds me of when everyone in the city started wearing Oshkosh Bagosh coveralls. Fine.
Right. Or like Docksiders went away, and then a bunch of people in Greenwich Village started wearing them again.
Right.
We've had a very significant groundswell in the past 3 to 4 years of pro snowboarders, pro skateboarders wearing our shirts.
Mm.
Last year, we did a collaboration with Element Skateboards where they picked 4 of our designs and put them on skateboards, and they were like best selling skateboards for them. So it's kind of transcended from being that joke.
Well, but how do you feel about the competing T-shirt seller, Zazzle.com, which the New York Times reports has come out with an understated Three Wolf T-shirt, which has no image. It simply says, three wolves howling at the moon.
I think it's a great tribute to us.
Michael McGloin, creative director of The Mountain, the New Hampshire-based company that makes the real Three Wolves Howling at the Moon T-shirt. Michael, thanks for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you so much for having me. Yeah.